identity in the physical world always starts with your face. Digital world is much worse than the physical world. When we make progress, we should move forward and not backward. I think the proof of personhood is a problem which is much smaller than most people think.
It sounds like a lot of industries actually getting driven to you just out of necessity.
Governments, huge banks for credit card companies.
I love it. This is what I came to Europe to find.
The launch team wishes you good luck and Godspeed.
Space Monkeys, blasting off with Ingo Ruba. He's the founder of Kilt Protocol, and very good to have him on the show at last. Ingo, welcome to Space Monkeys.
Thanks for having me.
Nice to have you here. You're one of the first projects I learned about when I entered the Polkadot ecosystem, one of the projects that opened my mind to what blockchain could do. This interest in identity, do you have any idea where this came from?
Actually, it wasn't an interest, it was a necessity. A little bit about the history of Kilt Protocol is that, or of me also, is that I worked as a CTO for a huge publishing company before. And then I came around blockchain. As a CTO, you come around blockchain. Like in 2015 or so, and in 2016, I actually got my mind together and went to the group board and said, actually, we have to do something in blockchain. It's going to be huge. And we say we are a tech and media company, so let's do the tech. And then I explained about blockchain. And then they said, okay, this is A, very complicated, and B, very far from our core business. But we see that you are really excited. So if you want to have a company doing that, just founded, we're going to give you the money and we get a share in the company. And you have to find us a new CTO, by the way. And if you accomplish all that, then you got your company and you go play with blockchain and you just come around every half year and tell us what you're doing. And then I said, okay, I probably have to do that. And then I had this company and a bank account, which was full of money. And then I had to think about what will I actually do with it. So we could have gone into trading or something, but I'm a computer scientist, so I want to build something. And then we looked around different options, like very close to the publishing context, like intellectual property rights and stuff like that. And then we always noticed, well, actually, it wouldn't really work because identity is missing on the blockchain. And then we noticed, wow, identity is actually also missing in the whole digital world. And then we thought, okay, because that turns up once over and over again, probably this is going to be the missing link between the real world and blockchain in the end. So as no one else is apparently doing it, let's do that. And this is how we went into identity.
Brilliant. And are you applying what you've built here at Kilt at all to the publishing company or?
To this publishing company, not, but to competitors of them.
I see. Understood. Okay. And I guess real quick to tie that up, what were you publishing?
At Border, which was the company, that was publishing, I think we had like more than 200 publications worldwide. So basically everything from gardening to whatnot and all that in digital and in print. So that's a huge company. They have like 12,000 employees worldwide. So that's a bigger one.
Well, identity does exist in a way on the web. I mean, I have my email and I have all these associations with everything I've signed up with that email since I was 15 or whatever. What about this identity system is unsatisfying to you?
That's a bit unsatisfying because it is worse than the one that we have in the physical world. In the physical world, we have actually a pretty decent system, which is decentralized, very much decentralized. I'll explain in a minute. And also very privacy preserving, which is nice. And also very fair. And in the digital world, it is not. So to explain that, why it is decentralized. So identity in the physical world always starts with your face. And your face is the most decentralized thing that you can have because it 100% belongs to you. Nobody gave it to you and no one can switch it off. And you decide when to show your face and when not. So that is as decentralized as possible. And everyone has their own. So it's fantastic. So and this is how identity is anchored. And around this anchor of identity, we built something that we call credentials, which can be your passport, but also your university degree and your fishing license and whatnot. And all those things have a picture on your face, of your face on it, so that you actually link the credential to your person. And the credential also is in your possession. So you decide when and if to show your phishing license or not, and to whom. And this makes it very decentralized. And also the issuers of those credentials are decentralized because the phishing license is issued by a different entity than your passport. So anyone can basically start being an issuer, which is, well, it's so blockchain actually, right? It's a totally decentralized world. And this works for 500 years. And I think it is close to perfection actually. And in the digital world, then you have your identity, as you said, your Gmail address or something like that. And this does not belong to you. This belongs to Gmail or to Google. It sits on their server and they can theoretically switch it off if they don't like you anymore. And what happens with that and where it is shown and when it is shown is not under your control because it's not in your pockets, not in your wallet. It's on somebody else's server. And this brings a lot of power to the identity providers that we have there, which is also not good because there's only two or three of them out there in the world, which is bad. It takes away the sovereignty from the people. So the digital world is much worse than the physical world. And actually, we should, when we make progress, we should move forward and not backward. And in terms of privacy and in terms of sovereignty of the people, we definitely move backward. And so there's a huge opportunity, actually, and blockchain can help there to move forward again and at least have the features that we have in the physical world also in the digital world. And this is what we're working on.
I'm hearing a couple of things in there. First is the identity tied to our face, because I'm and you are, we're unique individuals and we're separate. But then there's these credentials which are applied to us by, I guess, trusted
entities.
Entities that they have authority to say, well, this person is this age or this person has completed their boating license.
Those two belong together, and both together are identity. So it needs an individual anchor and it needs credentials, not only one, but many credentials. And those together form your identity. So at one point you are a person with this face, but you also have this nationality, you have these abilities, you have studied this and that, you can drive a car or not, and stuff like that. So all the credentials that you have in your purse together with your face actually represent your identity in a way.
So these trusted entities, I mean, this seems to be a very trust-based system. How are you fitting blockchain into the system here?
So first of all, you shouldn't have credentials on the blockchain. That's the most important thing because that's private data, right? It's personal data that you have a phishing license or not is actually not everyone should know that, right?
Yeah, right.
So you don't want to have the credentials on the blockchain. But maybe you want to have your anchor or parts of the anchor on the blockchain, because then you could be identified. So like you could actually show your face, for example, in a podcast. The idea is that when we have a digital anchor, which we call the decentralized identifier, the DID, that the DID, it consists of two parts, like a blockchain address. So you have the private part, which is always under your control, which is in your wallet, which never leaves the wallet, and which is basically, in the physical world, your signature. And then you have the public part, which is your face, and you can put that on the blockchain. And only if you have the signature together with the face, actually, you can sign something. So you can be identified by the face and then prove that this is actually your face. Your face is, of course, only a string of numbers, right? So, and then the credentials, they are issued by people who are identifiable, which is the, for example, a trusted entity. So the trusted entity has a DID so that one can be sure that this thing was actually signed, this credential was actually signed and issued by a trusted entity that people trust, and they can verify if this is the right entity and not just someone. And they are also issued to another DID so that it is clear that this credential is issued to you and not to anyone, to someone else. And only you can use that thing, like your passport. Your passport, so I can't use your passport because our faces are so different, right? So it must be clear that it's issued by a trusted entity and issued to a single person. And what you can then do is you can take this credential and put it in the wallet of the person. So it sits on your computer, on your phone. And the only thing that is stored on the blockchain there is a hash of the credential. So that if you can, if you use it, the verifier, which is the person that you show the credential to, can actually look up on the blockchain if this thing really exists, but not the contents of it, just the hash.
Yeah, yeah.
And it also brings the issuer the possibility that they can revoke the credential. Why is that important? A physical thing can always be taken from you. A virtual thing cannot be taken from you because it's just data, and data can always be copied.
Right.
So if I don't know, if I lose my driver's license for speeding or whatnot, then if it's a digital, I still have it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so you have to somehow... the driver's license department needs to have the possibility to say, this is not valid anymore.
Hmm.
And this is what we can do on the blockchain. We can say, this hash is not valid anymore.
Hmm.
So that you can, or I can, with my now invalid driver's license, which looks perfectly good for me, show that to someone. Then this someone can look up on the blockchain, is this actually a valid driver's license? And they say, yeah, it was, but not anymore. So this possibility for getting around this digital problem of that digital data cannot be really retrieved from someone, that is what we solve on the blockchain.
So I sign up for a DID and then I start collecting credentials from these trusted entities. Didn't you used to call them attesters?
So the official term is, I think, issuers.
Issuers.
We used to call them attesters for quite a while because they give attestations. But you can call them whatever you want, trusted entities, institutions,
sure,
whatnot. Important is that anyone can become one, right? You just get yourself a DID and say, I'm now a trusted entity.
Yeah.
And if people trust me, then my credentials are worth something. But this trust you don't accumulate on the blockchain. You accumulate the trust in the real world.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can use the blockchain as an infrastructure to actually distribute your credentials.
And I can prove that this institution trusts me or verifies that I am what I am.
For example.
I've been in this place. I guess it doesn't get that granular yet as far as attesters go, but it could get very much. Like you could build a whole reputation system around this
could
or something
build
like that.
A
right?
reputation system.
Yeah. Kind of interesting because, well, you know, in society, our identity is, I guess, defined mostly by what other people say we are. That's how we fit into society. Although there has been this movement where people say, well, my identity is what I say I am. But this doesn't actually translate onto the blockchain world so much.
Not very much. And I think that this movement is also probably not really complying with how people live.
Yeah,
actually,
right.
Actually, because identity has always been what people say about me, not what they actually say about me, but if they attest me or issue me like a university degree in computer science, they trust me that I can do programming probably. And if I just say I can do programming, they will always be, maybe first try it out.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, very interesting. So what's happened since you built this infrastructure? Who are doing the attesting? Who are these trusted entities that can issue credentials so far?
Yeah, so I think the most prominent one is probably Deloitte.
Yes.
Which is pretty interesting because they are doing exactly what we always envisioned. They are building business on top of that. So we know that issuing credentials is a huge business. And worldwide, in the credential business, there's lots of things happening. That's not only the governments issuing you a driver's license, which probably also costs $50 or something as a fee, but it's also universities. It's also the whole KYC market.
Yeah.
It's tons of things. It's actually a hugely a huge market, and it always works like that. You have to build up some trust.
Mm-hmm.
If you have built up some trust, then you can start issuing credentials, and then you can actually sell those credentials. Right. If you just sell them and not make any work behind that, like checking if you should really issue that credential, then they become worthless automatically because it will be the talk of the town that you can buy the credential there without any checks.
Yeah.
So you have to perform some work.
Mm-hmm.
And on this work, you get a premium actually for having the trust with it. So this is the business model of an issuer. And Deloitte was in the KYC business or KYB business more for, I don't know, probably 100 years or so. But it was more KYB. And why would you get a KYB credential from Deloitte? Because you were, I don't know, in a company, and this company would make a tour through some country and buy two or three companies there. Mm. And you had to be, and those companies had to be sure that you are actually can act on behalf of the company and stuff like that. So you were going through a KYB process there, probably very expensive, lots of paper, lots of stamps. And then you got all those paper with the stamps, and then you can travel to the country and say, yeah, Deloitte, you know Deloitte, right? They have a lot of trust. They checked it, so we can work together. And that's a business that they had for, I don't know, forever. And they decided, okay, let's also do that in KYC, actually, for the individual. Let's make it in a way that people can actually afford it. Hmm. And let's grow in that way. But let's not make it on paper, maybe. Let's do it digital. So they were coming from paper and moving into the digital KYC. Mm-hmm. And they said, let's skip the Web 2. Let's do it right in the beginning. Like, what is modern right now? How should you actually do that?
Sure.
And they came around DIDs and verifiable credentials and said, well, and then if we could anchor that on a blockchain, wouldn't that be really nice? Because then it's really true what we say. Let's build the business like that. And this is actually fantastic because they are building a business, hopefully earning tons of money. We're totally happy with that.
Yeah.
And using our infrastructure and bringing us and the word about Kilt out in the world. So this is the best case that we can have.
Does this start to address this sort of civil resistance, this proof of personhood problem? Is this a problem that you think can be solved?
I think the proof of personhood is a problem which is much smaller than most people think. Mm. Many points, I'm not really interested if it's a person or not. Hmm. You need that for voting, no question.
Okay.
But other than voting, I have not heard of a use case. Hmm. What comes up as a use case very often right now is AI. I want to know if this article was written by a person or by an AI.
Right.
No, you don't want to know that. Because this information is not worth anything, because AIs lie and people lie.
Yeah.
People lie for much longer than machines, but machines are now just learning to lie. It's the same thing. And as journalists and so on using AI for producing content more and more, they probably are being lied to by machines, even though they have actually published something they think it's them, and you don't
right.
know. So even an article which is produced by a person is probably half written by an AI now. So why would you want to know if it's a machine or not?
Interesting.
So this is pushed right now. I know proof of personhood. Many people are very interested in that. Really interesting for anything around voting in crypto and outside crypto.
Sure.
But other than that, I don't see a lot of use cases for that, actually.
Mm.
I think what's really much more important is accountability. A proof of accountability is something that would be really nice.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really care if I'm lied to, if a person is accountable for it, or if an organization is accountable for it, or if a machine is accountable for it. But I just want this accountability. But this is much more interesting. So if I make a decision which was based on false information which somebody gave to me, I want this person to be liable. And with journalists, we have that very often. So in publishing, you have an editor-in-chief, you have a brand, and so on. And so if you, as a journalist, constantly lie, even though you don't, you shouldn't, and you... So maybe you're supposed to lie, but that's a different story. So if you're not supposed to lie, but you still lie, then you will get in trouble with your editor-in-chief and the company, and eventually you get fired.
Mm.
Even if you do that in your free time, posting total bullshit outside on your own Twitter account can kill your job inside a publishing house when people can make the relation between you and the brand.
Right.
And this is accountability, because you live off that salary, and if you don't get the salary, you at least get a little bit punished for doing wrong, right? So we do have accountability, again, in the real world, not to an extent how it should be, but we have some kind of accountability there. And if we could move that into the digital world and also apply that to artificial intelligences, that would be really interesting, because then it would be people would think twice if they make an AI system and push it out into the world and they don't care if it lies or not. Mm. They would really care that it doesn't lie if they would be accountable for all the lies that they say.
Can you clarify how you would put accountability in a system like this? Because who would attest to what is true?
Really interesting question. We are about to write, together with others, scientific articles on that.
Yeah.
So this is very much in the beginning. So you can think of many. You can think of, for example, of DAOs. Take publishers together. They all have to put in some stake. And if something is proven of going in the wrong direction, then they could lose their stake and stuff like that. So there's a lot of really interesting governance.
Because this whole fact checker movement, I think that kind of fell apart a little quickly there, where now the trust in fact checkers is not so great, right? Mm-hmm. But having something at stake would be it.
Yeah. So this is probably something we're going to see in a couple of years.
Okay.
But it's already being discussed, and not only in the blockchain world, but also very much outside the blockchain world. Mm. So there's just a couple of weeks I was on a conference which was organized by the Aspen Institute. They are very much interested in these governance models for how to actually, not control artificial intelligence, but get accountability into artificial intelligence. Very important for the future.
Very, very good. Now, ID doesn't only apply to people, as you said. In fact, I probably imagine maybe even on Kilt, the Kilt network right now, you have far more machines that have identity than humans.
I think it's so. If you limit it to humans, you're making a mistake, because AIs are coming.
Yeah.
We never did this. We always said it's good for machines, for services, for even for virtual things like NFTs. Also, yeah. Those can have an identity in a way. But of course, also, I think the most interesting machine thing that we're doing is the DIVE project, which is together with the German Energy Foundation.
Yeah.
They are basically putting identities on smart meters. Sounds crazy, but is quite useful for balancing the grid, because the information. So smart meters are not only there for counting the energy that you use, but also interesting for the energy that you produce or could potentially produce, because you have photovoltaic on your roof or something in the garden which produces electricity. And it would be really good if the grid itself would know how much energy to expect from you at maximum, because then it could be balanced out in a much better way. And this is going to save a lot of energy, because right now we are losing a lot of energy because it's just not there at the point where we need it. And if that could be directed through the grid a little bit better, then we would be able to save a lot of energy, not even have the need to produce it in the first place, because it is there. We just have to direct it in the right direction. And this is what the DIVE project is working on. Mm-hmm. Of course, the machines which are involved there, they need an identity. And the identity provider for that is the smart meter, which is in your house, mm-hmm. and which is equipped with some credentials, and the credentials are issued by, for example, the people who install your photovoltaics and say, this thing can produce 10 kilowatts of electricity maximum. And if you mix that up with the weight and weather data, then you probably know how much energy is to be expected from there.
Sure. Really? So this is like the whole world of IoT, basically.
That's IoT.
And our devices already have IDs. They have serial numbers and whatnot.
Yeah, but you need a little bit more.
Yeah.
Right? Just a number is just a number. But mm-hmm. In this case, you also need the credentials, because you need to know how much energy is going to be. And no one is centrally able to do that. This is a decentralized task, because there's not one provider who connects all the photovoltaic appliances to your smart meter. This is a small company which is from around the corner, probably, mm-hmm. or you do it yourself. Mm-hmm. Right?
How do you get in contact with all these big industry? I mean, you have Deloitte, you have, you're working with Dina.
I think another enterprise customer is Axel Springer, which is a publishing house here in Germany.
Right.
They are more on the side of the logins. So they have tons of websites, mm-hmm. Those websites have premium accesses. that can be premium access because you bought something, but maybe also because you just have trust. For example, commenting on articles doesn't require that you pay, but it requires that you have trust. And this should be a trust which is revocable, because if you do good for the first 2 weeks and then it turns out you are complete crazy, then you should be actually taking this right away. So they actually need credentials, and they need logins, and they need logins in a Web3 way, because they want to get a little bit away, like hopefully many publishers in the future, from this centralized identities. And they need to be GDPR compliant, and the stuff that we do is 100% GDPR compliant, because the data is never stored in a central place. It's always stored with the user. I can store my data as long as I want. And it's not on the blockchain, because the personal data is not stored on the blockchain. So it's GDPR safe. And publishers notice very much right now that they have a huge burden with the data that they collect, because they can't use it for things like artificial intelligence, because it's just not enough. So if you really want to be big in artificial intelligence, you have to be Google or Facebook, because there you have the amounts of data that really make a difference. If you are a publisher, even if you're the biggest publisher in the world, which Axel Springer probably is, I don't know, maybe place two or three, then you still don't get enough data to be relevant in the AI set. So they have all that data, and the data is now a burden, because anyone, at least from Europe, can call them and say, find all the data about me and delete it until tomorrow. And if not, I'm going to court. So this is, when this is spread over hundreds of databases, this is a completely impossible task. So the publishers now notice, we have too much data. We have to get rid of it. Where can it be? Okay, let's give it to the users. This is why we're working with those guys.
No way. Are there other people trying to solve this these problems with GDPR as well?
Well, I know from other publishers that there are, that they know that they need to solve it.
Yeah, okay.
Not saying how far they are.
Well, here we are. He's killed. Okay, brilliant. Okay, so it sounds like a lot of industries actually getting driven to you just out of necessity then.
Yeah, looks like. So we don't really have a huge business development department which does cold calls. So the only thing that we do is we are present. We're trying to do good things. We are active in the development of the standards, like DIDs and verifiable credentials. So we are on the scientific part.
Yes,
we are visible. We are also visible apparently a little bit in the industry part already. And we try to be visible in the blockchain world as well. Mm-hmm. So this is where we are. And then people just start talking about us. And then the only thing that we can do is be nice and helpful. And this is what we're trying.
So amazing. In the blockchain world, let's talk about some of the partners you have at Polkadot. Moonsama.
Moonsama, for example,
yes.
We work with. We work with the guys from Frequency.
Yeah.
We work with the guys from Water Protocol. Mm-hmm. So now I forgot like 25 of them. So we just made an amazing cooperation with Nova and Apilon, right? We just finished something.
Nice.
A lot, especially in the Polkadot ecosystem, apparently. So there's many nice and very intelligent people where it's really fun to work with.
Polkadot's changing a lot. The whole parachain model is disappearing. We're going to this, I guess instead of leasing, we're going to be buying this core time now. How does this affect your business model and everything you've been doing up to this point?
Yeah, this is a little complicated for us, because the idea of parachains was, for those who are into parachains, was that you basically go to an auction and then you win a slot for the next 2 years and you put down some dots for that. Mm-hmm. And after the 2 years, the dots are released again, so you have them back, mm-hmm. and you can use them for maybe getting the next slot or for doing whatever you want with it. But you would also need to get the next slot after 2 years. And for us, that was very, very practical. And I think also I liked the idea very much, because it was a little bit like we're all trying to move in the same direction. Because when I put down 100,000 dot for, I don't know what they're worth today, $4 per piece, then that's 400,000. And then after 2 years, I get them back. And if Polkadot does good and the dot is 40, then hey, I 10x'd my money. The only cost that I had was actually the opportunity cost of not staking it at that time. So that was that's everyone moves in the same direction. We all want to make Polkadot successful and so on. My feeling is when they turn around and say, now this model is gone and now we have to buy the core time there, like we basically do in Ethereum, then we are not working in the same direction anymore. We're working in two different directions because I, as a business, because then a business, the blockchain is then a business, or the parachain is a business, I want to buy this infrastructure as cheap as possible, which means I'm not really interested in how successful Polkadot is. I'm actually interested in Polkadot not being successful. I think they turned that around a bit, which is sad. And I also think that the parachain model, which is still somehow surviving, it's not totally gone. It's just not 2 years. Now you have to buy, and you have to buy for 2 months or something.
Every month.
Yeah. But you can buy a little bit before and have and hold NFTs and stuff like that. Uh-huh. So there's tons of fantastic ideas in there. It somehow jeopardizes the most important USP that Polkadot had. And that was that you can actually have your peace of mind for the next 2 years and run this parachain thing. I totally understand why they moved away from that, because it was not very successful. It's not, so complaining is always good, but the core time that Polkadot offers is not used, right?
Yeah.
So there's, I think, 30 or 40 parachains right now, and they're all basically empty. So Polkadot produces a lot of security. And this security could be used by many, many people for many, many applications, but the parachains were just not successful enough. Hmm. And so they are blocking this space, and moving away from that is totally understandable. They want to open it to more users in the end, and then make more use of what Polkadot can offer. But for those who are already there, I think some of them are not feeling too well about changing this model.
Right. Why do you think this parachain model failed? Was it just the timing of the market, or do you think there's another reason why it didn't quite work out?
I think there is actually another reason. So when we go back in the very old ancient history of Polkadot, like 2017, then what we talked about with the guys from Polkadot was basically that the customer for the or the user of the parachain, the parachain itself, would not be a small business like Kilt or the others. It was more meant for governments, for huge banks, for credit card companies, for big tech companies and stuff like that. And they started also conversations with them. I know that. So they would probably buy those parachain slots for a huge amount of money. And then obviously also renew that after a while. And this is also why it was in the beginning actually limited to 100, because they thought, hey, 100 big companies all using that for blockchain. And I think there were also really interesting USPs for those companies in there. Like you can define as a company running a parachain how open you want the system to be. You could say, I have only one collator, that's me. You can say there's only two nodes, RPC nodes, and I totally control who accesses those RPC nodes. So it could be used for banks, even protecting the bank secrets and stuff like that.
Sure.
So really interesting features, which you don't find on Ethereum and so on.
Right.
You find them on Hyperledger if you want, but on Hyperledger it's just a database and there's no external security whatsoever. Mm. So you would have had the nice features of the security of the decentralized network, which comes in from Polkadot, but you still could control your own network in a way that you need to control it for legal compliance or personal reasons. That was a huge feature. It was resonating, I think, also very good. But unfortunately, this was moved away from, and then the parachains went to small companies like us. In the beginning, we thought, maybe Kusama is the right place for us. Probably we'll never move to Polkadot because this is where the big fish work, right?
Right, right.
And now all the small fish like us came into the Polkadot slots.
Yeah.
And of course, when you have small companies just starting, basically, then they are not successful from day one and they will not produce the huge full chains that Polkadot was actually expecting. So if one credit card company would have had a parachain, they would really fill it up, right?
Sure.
We can't. So that's the difference. And this is why the parachains were not really successful. The companies which got them were just far too small.
well, what do we do about this? What happens now? I mean, we just last month had this big shakeup at Parity, for instance. So do you think there's a chance to go back to this original vision, or is it too late?
I think the whole system will not move back to that because the I think that the community, especially around Gavin, when he made his speech in Copenhagen, I think it is already a community decision to move more to the individual developer to get the chain filled or the core time used up by many and not by just 30 small parachains, but to open this up to the to a wider crowd of people. So that is moving from big to small to even smaller. Right now, this is where we are going. Mm-hmm. I think what we should do is that we try to simultaneously look again at the big companies if they want to run the still existing parachain model. I think that would be really wise because as we are working with companies and banks call us because they want to do something and they heard, oh, maybe identity is in there, and they start basically explaining their plans. So I know that there's a huge need for the features that Polkadot originally provided, like have a parachain as a big company and control it. And I think there's a huge chance for Polkadot. And what I would suggest is that we go do the plan that Polkadot is doing right now, but at the same time, also try the original plan again. So I think that would be really helpful because there is a huge market and we shouldn't neglect that.
Okay, beautiful. Do you want to describe your particular vision that you're building?
So the idea is that we should have, there will be after Polkadot or after Parity now let go their marketing and business development departments, there will be new players, maybe also the old players become new players, but there will be some people interested in this 40 million pot that the Web3 Foundation is now giving out for various reasons.
Yeah.
And I think some of them should actually be the old guys, like running the website and the Twitter account, these things. This is not a business model for anyone. It would be really good if we can find some consistency there. And I think that the majority of the money is going to be supportive of the idea, get the individual developer in.
Sure.
But what I would appreciate after the Pareto principle, like taking 20% of the money actually and putting it into moving to the original plan of Polkadot again and trying this out and building a business development or key accounting, I would call it, a key accounting business, which is actually a business. And that should be equipped with enough money to do lobbying. So not try to lobby yourself. Never try to lobby yourself. Don't call a politician. There's companies which do that for you and which open the doors for you and you just walk into the door and say, hi, here I am. Mm-hmm. I'm Polkadot. So I think we should do that. This is going to cost a lot of money, but it's going to be very interesting because not all the CDPC decisions have been made yet.
Yeah.
There's lots of things around also identity and stuff which are so government related. Healthcare, think of healthcare. The prescriptions are not really... in many countries, at least in Europe, they are still on paper. Sure. And then you have other countries also in Europe. Greece is a very good example for that, where it's totally centralized in one database, which everyone enjoys because it's so easy to use. Mm-hmm. But they just enjoy it as long as it's not hacked. And this is not a question of if, but of when.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, and then everyone will be totally unhappy with it. So there's lots of things which we have to do and where Polkadot actually can move in very nicely. So you just have to open the doors and tell the people that it exists because the awareness of Polkadot is absolutely zero right now. So the last person making really lobbying for Polkadot on the European level was Jutta. And she's gone for a couple of years now.
Yeah, right.
That was we have to do that, and we should have people in there which are not only very fluent in Polkadot and really understand the system, but also understand one vertical. So, for example, the gaming vertical, or the healthcare vertical, or the banking vertical. And what we're doing right now is that we're trying to put together a core group of people who could actually manage such a thing, and ask the Web3 Foundation if they would be interested in funding that.
That sounds like a fantastic vision for Polkadot, and one in alignment with what I understood Polkadot was intended to be when I first came here as well. So I hope it's within the wisdom of the Web3 Foundation to provide some funding to get this business going. That's super exciting. Would you step away from Kilt at all, or would you?
Not at all. No. We would. I think Kilt would be one of the beneficiaries of that, apparently, because that would bring in some new people who are interested, probably because identity comes with it, and it's actually a network of parachains, right? So you can use stuff within the parachains. Are quite interesting for us as well. But no, I think Kilt is right now in a very, very important phase, which is the phase of actually getting adoption.
Yeah.
And as we're going for these big deals, when you talk about companies like Deloitte or Axel Springer, this is not where you walk in and sign the deal. This takes years every time. So each of those deals takes forever. And we have something on the plate for the future, but we are definitely very busy for the next couple of years, and I can't just move away. So this is, and I don't want that. But what I can do is that I can, that we can bring the expertise and the experience which we had in Kilt from talking to politicians, from working with lobbying companies, from how to talk to big companies. We also have some experts in energy, for example. So we can put in experience and expertise, but we can't do the actual work.
I love it. This is what I came to Europe to find. I came to Europe to find people with visions to bring Polkadot forward, because there is this sense that it could go either way at this point. We could really fall completely off the horse, or we could pick ourselves up and move toward a future where Polkadot has a role in a better, more efficient, more secure, less centralized world. So I'm so glad that the publishing company gave you an opportunity to move over and try this out. And it's been a real pleasure having you on the show and hearing your story as well. So thanks very much for all you do. And thank you for being here.
It was much fun. Thank you very much.